Hello and welcome to your politics show here on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. This week we are talking to Daisy Cooper, the MP for St Albans.
We've seen that Boris Johnson announced that he will step down as PM after a Conservative leadership election. Are you pleased that he's left, or are you worried about the new potential leaders?
I am pleased that he's left, actually, because, I'm relieved, let's put it that way. I'm relieved that Johnson has finally decided to go, because I think he has eroded trust in, you know, eroded trust in politics. He's really broken trust with the public, and I think it was really good time that it really was time for him to go. As for the other leaders, I mean, I'm really concerned. You know, we've had two or three debates now on the television where potential leadership candidates have been, you know, setting out their stall, and we haven't really heard any serious plan to tackle the cost of living. We've heard, I think, almost nothing at all about NHS waiting times and the ambulance crisis that we're facing and the crisis in social care. And of course, the two candidates who are now the two who are left vying to become the next prime minister have spent, you know, months, if not years, defending Boris Johnson and his legacy. And they waited until the last possible moment to get rid of him when it was politically expedient to do so. So I am concerned that we're not hearing anything credible from them, particularly on cost of living and NHS wait times.
And just on Boris Johnson himself, you were very critical of him in your leaving kind of summary. You said Boris Johnson will go down in history as a lying, law-breaking prime minister. You also said that he attacked our democratic institutions and will leave a stain on the Conservative Party. But has there been anything positive that you can say about his time as prime minister?
I guess the only thing I would say, I mean, it's very difficult to know whether other prime ministers would have done things differently or better. I mean, you know, he has shown a degree of leadership on the Ukraine issue. Whether or not other prime ministers would have done the same, I hope that they would have done. I mean, I've certainly been clear that I support everything that the government does to provide military support to Ukraine. I would hope, obviously, I've been critical in the past about the way that the refugee situation has been handled, and it's still a bit of a mess, quite frankly. So, I mean, you know, yeah, he showed some leadership there. Obviously, some people have suggested that it might have been politically convenient for him to do so because it was around the time that various allegations came out. I mean, who knows? It's very difficult to say what the cause of that was. But aside from that, I have to say he leaves a legacy which is absolutely shameful. And I think he has got so much wrong over the last 2 years, whether it's in the handling of the pandemic or whether it's sitting on his hands on the cost of living crisis. I'm just relieved that he's gone. And I think what we can now see is there are so many splits within the Conservative Party. You know, the two candidates have got fundamentally different views on how the economy is going and what needs to happen. It does really make me worry that we don't actually really know what the Conservative Party stands for. And it clearly doesn't seem to have a plan either.
I mean, on this issue of the two potential leaders, then, can you see yourself being able to work with either of them?
Well, it depends what you mean by work with. I mean, fundamentally, I would like to get rid of the whole of this Conservative government if I could. But for as long as the Conservatives are in power, I mean, I will, of course, work with anybody from any political party if it's going to help my constituents in St Albans. So there are always areas where you can find cross-party consensus. And obviously, I'll continue to lobby both of them or either of them, depending on who wins the contest. So, you know, as I say, If I have to work with one of them in order to deliver for my constituents, then of course I will do that. But in a political sense, fundamentally, it's really my role as an opposition party to hold them to account and to lobby them. So that's what I'll continue to do.
We've talked previously how you would never unite with Boris Johnson, form some sort of government with him. Is that the same for Sunak and Truss?
Yeah, it absolutely is. This Conservative Party is, you know, so different from anything the Conservative Party used to be. This is a very, very right-wing Conservative Party, and that includes, you know, both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. So, yeah, absolutely, we won't be working with them at all.
On this issue, as you said there, they're so fundamentally different from one another, but also from Boris Johnson. Do you believe that this decision should have gone to a general election rather than to the limited number of Conservative members?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, on the one hand, we live in a parliamentary democracy, so it's a party that is elected rather than any individual prime minister. But that said, both of these new leadership contests, or these leadership candidates, are proposing such a departure from what the Conservative Party said it was going to do in its general election manifesto, that yes, I do think there should be a general election. The world has changed enormously since the last general election. They haven't stuck to their promises. They've broken many promises in their manifesto, and I think people are very concerned, rightly concerned, that this party is going to change tack and leave its manifesto to one side altogether. I mean, you know, it really does make a mockery of our democracy when you can make some pledges and then do the exact opposite. And so I think there is a real desire amongst the public to want to have a say, and I think they're right.
Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak are already explaining their ideas for building back better, or whatever the kind of slogan is at the moment. But Keir Starmer has also been doing the same, presenting his ideas. But could you illuminate to us what the Lib Dems' ideas would be if you were involved in these arguments as well?
Sure. Well, we've spent months and months and months putting concrete ideas forward, actually, on a whole range of issues. So on the cost of living, for example, we were the first party, before Labour nicked it, the first party to set out the proposal for a windfall tax. Very pleased the government adopted it, but frustrated because our proposal would have raised £11 billion and Rishi Sunak's only raised £5 billion and then gave a bit of a freebie to companies that were going to invest in oil and gas, and we should have been diverting them towards more renewables. We've proposed an emergency VAT cut to put money back in people's pockets and to help tackle inflation. We said we'd reverse the national insurance rise, which is a very unfair tax that falls squarely on the shoulders of those least able to afford it. So those are three of the ideas we put forward on the cost of living. On NHS and social care wait times, you know, we've said time and time again there needs to be a workforce strategy, and it's just really disappointing that the government spent 8 months fighting that idea and refused to put into law a commitment on all future governments to produce a workforce strategy in Parliament. And, you know, our NHS and social care really are social care services. They're built on our staff. You know, they're run by our staff. And if you can't get the right people, it doesn't matter how good your IT system is. It doesn't matter how many scanners you have. It doesn't matter how many ambulances you have, if you haven't got the people to use them and drive them and everything else. And so we really need to have this workforce strategy in place. And also so that the staff that we do have, who are exhausted, stressed out after the pandemic, so that they know that the cavalry is coming. So those are just some of the ideas that we're already putting forward.
Continuing this examination of ideas that have been bandied around, Keir Starmer has now stated that there's no case for the UK to return to the EU. But with the latest poll showing that 53% of people would vote Remain now after seeing what has happened after Brexit, do you feel that your position as a party is also representing a large sector of the population who aren't having their views on this aired?
Yeah, so I think what we can see is that the Conservatives' Brexit deal has caused a huge number of problems. It's introduced enormous amounts of red tape, which means that, you know, lots of businesses and manufacturers, including in my constituency of St Albans, are really struggling to export goods out of the UK, and they're struggling to import goods as well. So there's a lot of red tape that's causing problems, and we've seen people on the TV, you know, with the piles and piles and piles of extra paper they have to fill in. And what this now means is that there's now a lot of companies that are being formed to deal with that paperwork, and it's putting an extra overhead on some of these businesses. So we've seen the red tape that the Tories' Brexit deal has created. We've seen that we've now got a massive shortage of labour in everything from health and social care to HGV drivers to engineers, you know, right across the board, hospitality as well. So we're struggling with that. And it also means that people in the UK are missing out on many of the opportunities that we used to have, including young people. So what Liberal Democrats have said is that we believe, and we always have believed, and we will continue to believe, that the UK's position is better off having a close relationship with Europe. We have a four-stage process set out as our party policy about how we want to build that closer relationship. And that starts with improving the replacement schemes that the government put in place, joining some new schemes, whether that's around science, research and development and education. And those can be that can be done immediately. And then longer term, we want to improve the trade deals that have been negotiated to replace our relationship with the EU, because many of those trade deals were really not very good and are incredibly damaging for farmers. And then in the long term, we'll be looking to rejoin the single market. So that's our position.
And just on our previous discussions, we have talked about this, but has Keir Starmer's ideas about Europe maybe changed your position? Because I did ask you, would the Liberal Democrats support or even work with a Labour minority government? Has this changed anything at all?
I mean, fundamentally, when it comes to the next election, Liberal Democrats are not taking any votes for granted. And we certainly wouldn't be seeking to predict the outcome. It'd be hugely arrogant to predict the outcome of the next election, particularly when we don't even know when it's going to be, right? We have no idea what the big issues of the day will be. We have no idea who's going to be the leader of the Conservative Party. I think there's still quite a lot of questions that remain, certainly for me, about the Labour Party and its platform. So, I mean, we're just nowhere near even contemplating what might happen in the future. What I am clear about is that Liberal Democrats have always believed and will continue to believe that we do need a closer relationship with the EU. We will always make that argument. And we've set out a four-stage process as to how to build that closer relationship with Europe. The Labour Party are obviously a different party. They're very distinct. They're distinctive from us. They can come up with their own policy. I'm very clear as to what our policy is and we'll continue to bang the drum for it.
So earlier this month, you said that the so-called war on drugs is failing and that we need to take a public health approach. What would this new approach look like, Daisy?
Sure. Well, at the moment, drugs are seen through the lens of criminal activity. So anybody who is using drugs or buying drugs or selling drugs, it's seen, you know, say predominantly through a crime perspective, and therefore the initial response is done by the police. I do think that drugs need to be seen through a public health lens and seen as a health issue. And that would mean that if people were found to be using drugs, that it would be given the offer and support of health services. There would be a way of providing more sort of treatment and support to help people with addiction. So it is seen as a health issue, not as a criminal issue. As part of this, we know that that marijuana is still seen and used as a gateway drug. Liberal Democrats have said for a long time there are a number of problems with the use of marijuana at the moment, which is mostly that it's being grown to be much stronger than it used to be, and it's the strength of the content of it that causes such enormous mental health problems and can trigger schizophrenia in some users. And so the strength of it is a real problem. But also when people buy, when they buy weed, effectively that money is going into the hands of criminal gangs. And so what Liberal Democrats have said for many years now is that if you sort of medicalise and legalise the use of marijuana, you're taking the money out of the hands of criminal gangs, and you can regulate it, and you can regulate the strength that it's grown at, so it can be grown at a much reduced strength, so it isn't as damaging and it isn't as harmful to people, and you're taking the money out of the hands of criminal gangs, and you're pumping that money back into public health services, including the health services needed to get people off drugs altogether.
Also on the issue of health, your mandate this month has particularly been stretchy. You've been working very, very hard because we saw the heat wave crisis. So first and foremost, what do you believe needs to be done for preparation for future events like this?
Well, to be honest, there isn't a silver bullet. The fact is the Conservative government have been running our health services into the ground for years and years and years. And we do need a huge turnaround in the way that the government approaches our health services. So there is a heat wave strategy, right? The heat wave strategy was activated last week when we had the heat wave. But the problem is that there are many hospitals in particular that are so old that they're not fit for having ventilation systems or air conditioning. And some of them are so old that the temperatures got really, really high inside the hospitals. And of course, because social care hasn't been fixed, even though Boris Johnson claimed he'd fixed it, he actually hasn't fixed social care. And the national insurance rise, which social care providers have to pay for, now, you know, it's actually causing many social care homes to close down. You know, social care isn't fixed and you haven't got the workforce to run care homes, then of course you can't get people out of hospitals. So, I mean, the fact is we have the whole system is under so much pressure that there isn't a silver bullet to solve this. So what we need is a long-term strategy where we start fixing these buildings. The government claims it's building new hospitals, but it's not releasing the funds so that these hospitals can be fixed. We need a workforce strategy so that we've got the right number of staff in NHS and in our social care so they can deal with these extra pressures when they come along. And we need institutions that can act sooner. You know, we have lots of different bodies in the health sector who often work in silos, and you have public health at one end and you've got the ambulance trust at another, and you've got the mental health unit separately, and you've got hospitals separately and GPs separately. And there currently isn't the right sort of structure to make sure that every part of the NHS is working towards the same goal and can jump into action sooner. So as I say, I'd love to say there's a silver bullet and a single thing the government could do, but quite frankly, we need a long-term strategy to invest in our buildings and our workforce.
I mean, are a lot of these answers similar to your kind of highlighting that hospitals are running out of space and staff as well? Does this carry over? Because you said that the government needs to commit to removing any barriers to extra staff and resources. You called for that actually in Parliament this month. I mean, has there been any progress on this at all?
So, I mean, it's very frustrating. So when you get into this situation of sort of the heat wave emergency, you know, people were very concerned that we might end up in a situation where patients were going to be left, you know, outside in car parks and things like that, you know, under sort of gazebos. And I don't believe that there was, certainly I didn't see any photographs of that happening. I didn't see any reports of that happening, but there were concerns that that could have happened because hospitals were quite rightly told that patients shouldn't be in the back of an ambulance for longer than half an hour once they arrive at a hospital. And that's a good thing because you want to get patients out of the ambulances that themselves are overheating and get them into the hospitals where they can be cared for. But where the hospitals are running out of beds and where the hospitals are running out of space, it raises the question of where do you put these people? And as soon as they're in the hospital, they need to be under clinical supervision. And of course, if you haven't got enough people to look after them, then that also presents another problem. So, I mean, the reason I raised this last week is because there were suggestions from some of the health leaders I was talking to in Hertfordshire that it was really important that hospitals had access to, say, paramedics in the fire service or paramedics and ambulance drivers from the army. And it wasn't clear that when they said we need extra staff, it wasn't quite clear that the government had done everything possible to make sure that those extra staff were available. Now, in the end, I think our health services, I mean, just about coped. And I mean, literally just about coped. And there weren't any massive, massive disasters. But I do think that we need to be planning ahead in future, and that where we do have people with medical expertise in other emergency services, if they're not being used in those services, then they should be redeployed, I think, to our hospitals.
Now, on the issue of COVID prevention, you have been talking about this for months in terms of getting special drugs for compromised immune system peoples. You've explained that something like Evusheld or other such medicines are really good for keeping the numbers down and protecting really vulnerable people, but they've still not been purchased. What is the reason behind this delay, Daisy?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think I'm getting to the stage now where we really need to bang some heads together. Fundamentally, when I met with the vaccines minister again last week, what she said to me was that these preventative COVID drugs, which would be for people who are immune compromised and who are therefore effectively, if they go out into the world and they catch COVID, they might die. It really is a kind of life or death decision for them. The vaccines minister basically said that she felt there wasn't enough evidence as to whether or not this drug would actually work against particular strands of the Omicron variant. And therefore, until she saw the evidence of whether that worked or not, she didn't want to purchase any of this drug because she's very concerned that people, particularly these very vulnerable people, would change their behaviour. And if they change their behaviour, they might then go and catch COVID, and that could have a devastating effect if we didn't know 100% sure. So that sounds okay in theory, but equally at the same time, we're being told by the pharmaceutical company that has developed this drug that it has tested this drug against those particular variants, that it is confident that it works, and yet the government is saying it hasn't seen that evidence, and I think the pharmaceutical company is saying that it has. So we're now at the stage where we're really trying to bash heads together, where the government seems to be willing to look at buying this drug but says there isn't enough evidence yet, and the pharmaceutical company that has developed it is saying that there is evidence, and it's really quite difficult for those of us in opposition to get them to come together and bash heads and actually and purchase this drug. And I wish the government would get on with it, because the challenge that we have is that the pharmaceutical company has limited manufacturing capacity. And once it receives a certain number of orders from other countries, there won't be enough manufacturing capacity for the UK government to buy up some of this drug. So it really is a race against time to buy this drug, which could prove, and which we're told does prove to be effective and support the most clinically vulnerable people, many of whom are still living under a form of lockdown.
So moving it to the local area, were you excited to see that St Albans is trialling an all-electric refuse collection vehicle?
Yeah, I think it's great news. And I, you know, I'll be interested to see what the results of that trial are. I mean, clearly this is a decision of the local district council. I haven't had any involvement in it at all, but I'm all in favour of initiatives that are good for the environment and help us to take pride in our area, which I think we do, particularly when we can clear up rubbish and be good for the environment at the same time.
And on another kind of local initiative that's eco-friendly, but this has been done by the private company of Aylett's Nurseries. They've introduced lots of electric charging points. Does it make you happy to see that the city is embracing, maybe leading the line in these essential changes for an eco-friendly future?
Yes, absolutely. We know that the climate emergency is already here. You know, we can't talk about it anymore as if it's something in the future. We know that it's here already. It's affecting our weather and our climate, and you know, the heat wave is a very clear indication of that. So yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to see this kind of infrastructure. But I mean, let's be honest, we've got to ramp it up massively. And that's only going to happen with encouragement, investment and incentives from central government. I think a lot of people are desperate for local and national government to go faster and to go further. I think a lot of people would buy an electric vehicle if they felt that they could. But in many cases, it's far too expensive. And secondly, the infrastructure just isn't, there isn't enough infrastructure around. So I think the more of this we can get, the better. But I mean, let's be serious about this. We've got to get a much bigger investment by central government and local governments to make that happen.
One of those things that will help the green future of this country is to do with trains. But you had a meeting with Thameslink to discuss issues at St Albans Station, including disabled accessibility. Have you been assured that things will improve? And is there a time frame that people can expect to see the improvements delivered?
Sure, there were a number of different issues actually that people had raised with me to bring up with Thameslink in my most recent meeting. So one was around the buttons, which the buttons next to the lift that indicate whether you're going up or down. And I think it's Braille that's on the actual buttons. And I think the buttons were possibly the wrong way around. And so Thameslink are looking at that at the moment, and they'll get back to me and tell me whether they've managed to fix that. There was another issue where somebody had raised concerns about security around motorbikes. Now, as we know, Thameslink have finally introduced a secure area for regular pedal bikes, but there are still some people who use motorbikes, and that area, I think there's been quite a lot of sort of thefts or break-ins, and people are very concerned about it. And they have been in contact with Thameslink and haven't received a response. So I've chased that up, and I've been told there will be a response to that. And you know, obviously, ultimately, we need to have an integrated transport system, don't we? If people are going to use the train, we want people to be able to walk or cycle to the train station. And they're not going to do that if their bikes and their helmets keep getting nicked. So it's really important that we can make that safer.
Yesterday, we also saw distressing scenes as a fire engulfed a car workshop and a row of commercial units on London Road. What's the latest news on this, Daisy?
So thankfully, there were no injuries and no fatalities. And I think that is a huge, huge relief. I'm not sure that the origins of that fire have yet been detected. And if they have, I'm not aware of it. I was actually due to go and meet the fire service on London Road yesterday afternoon. And as soon as I saw that plume of smoke go up, I was pretty certain that meeting was going to be cancelled, which it was. But I was very concerned about the businesses down there. And I know a couple of them. So I phoned them up and said, are you okay? And some of them, they said, yep, we're out of the building. Everyone's safe. We've got food and water, but we're being kept at the end of the car park and we can't get out at the moment. And so I was in touch with some of the people who were there. And I've had an update from the fire service this morning. Obviously, it's all under control now. But we do know that some of the businesses are basically irreparable. And I think the local gym in particular has already launched a crowdfunder to try and raise funds to rebuild the business. So if anybody is a user or supporter of that gym, I tweeted about it earlier. You can find the link there.
Yeah, I've been there myself. And, you know, it'd be fantastic to see it return back to its former glory. But on to the community questions, and Susan has asked, Daisy, what is going to happen with Precious Homes care home that was placed into special measures due to it being run so poorly? What about the safety of the residents?
It's a really good question, actually. So the Care Quality Commission, which is the regulator for care homes, has done a report, and it's been rated at the lowest level on every single metric. And that's very, very worrying, because this care home looks after people with learning disabilities and autism and other mental health needs. And the report from the CQC has found that there were serious concerns around the level of care that was provided, very serious concerns about how medicine was administered, serious concerns about training not being provided, as well as the high turnover of staff. And so I completely understand that anybody who has a loved one in that care home will be very concerned about these findings. What the CQC report says is that when a home is rated so low and when the performance is so poor, they will go and do another. They give very firm recommendations about what needs to change, and they go back and do another assessment within 6 months. And the maximum amount of time that a care home can remain at this lowest level of being inadequate is 12 months in total. If they start to improve, then the CQC will continue to monitor them until it improves to a satisfactory level. If they don't improve, then the CQC has the powers to effectively cancel their registration and will then have to go through the process of trying to find places for people to be cared for elsewhere. So I do recognise it's very concerning. And if anybody has specific concerns, I would encourage them to contact me directly on my parliamentary email address. But as I say, the CQC is a reasonably sort of good regulator in terms of it has a good structure, and it is prepared to use its powers when necessary. So I hope the CQC in this case does follow up as it says it's going to.
Carl has moved the discussion, though, onto roads in the area. He said, I just heard about a detailed proposed closure of the junction of Sotwell Lane and Old London Road. Apparently, there was a consultation, he says, but not including anyone I know from the immediately impacted area. He goes on to say, how can this silly idea be allowed to go ahead when only 100 people in the area were consulted?
Yeah, I think Carl is right to ask this question. So, I mean, it's a slightly harebrained idea. I mean, this is basically about trying to find a way of introducing a cycle route, which in itself is a good idea. But there's about 2/3 of the route that seems to make sense and 1/3 of it that really doesn't. And I think it's the bit that doesn't make sense that Carl is asking about. Fundamentally, as I understand it, the county council, this is a county council matter, the county council has applied for some funding from central government from a particular pot of money to encourage active travel. But as part of that, they have to find real world data to prove whether an idea would work or not work. And this consultation may well result in some kind of a trial going ahead. But I would, as I understand it, I think the consultation is still open. I would encourage Carl and lots of other residents to respond to it. If he doesn't have those details, then I would encourage him to contact his county councillor, who is likely to either be, if he's directly affected by this issue, it'll either be Chris White or Sandy Walkington. But I would encourage Carl to contact his own county councillor about this issue, because they're best placed to raise those concerns at county level.
Amy has raised concerns about litter in the area. She said, can people please pick up after going to the parks? People are leaving so much litter around.
Yeah, well, I agree with Amy on this. I mean, it is pretty awful, isn't it? I mean, just yesterday I was down by the Abbey and it's clear that under one of the trees, a group of people had, I don't know, gone to Tesco's or somewhere and bought a whole load of sandwiches and left about sort of a dozen empty sandwich wrappers as well as empty bottles and things lying underneath a tree. It was really horrible. I mean, there's really no need for that. So, I mean, I agree with Amy. Yes, I wish people could pick up their litter. It kind of seems like a fairly kind of common sense, no-brainer thing to do. Of course, if Amy or anybody else spots examples of litter all over the place, you know, by all means, report it. You can report it directly onto the St Albans District Council website, and then that can be passed on to the contractor who can go and clear up those areas.
Camilla has said, we saw Affinity Water say the Hearts residents needed to avoid non-essential water usage during the heat wave. But can things go back to normal now?
Tricky answer on this one, Camilla. I think it's not a straight yes or no. It's more that we probably all need to continue to provide support on this issue. So the fact is we are over the heat wave now. And the issue is that when it gets incredibly hot, we need to preserve the water for people to use for drinking water. And if people use loads of water for other things as well, it draws down on the supplies of water that are available and can result in low water pressure in some parts of the area. So it's really important to keep use down, particularly at peak times. But we do know that it sounds like we're going to be in for a long dry summer. And therefore, we do need to continue to preserve water. There are some tips on the Affinity Water website about how people can do this. And I'd encourage people not to use water for non-essential things like, you know, sounds a bit sort of party pooperish, but, you know, paddling pools and, you know, spray on the garden and things like that. You know, try and use a water butt rather than, you know, recycle water rather than using fresh water out of the tap. I do know that this is a very difficult message to hear from Affinity Water because many of us have seen leaks all around the city. There's a massive one on London Road at the moment. I know that local councillor Jackie Taylor has reported this two or three times. There's been a bit of a Twitter spat today with Jackie showing Affinity Water when she reported it, and Affinity Water denying they'd even seen the report. So anybody interested in that particular leak can follow Jackie on Twitter. But you know, it is frustrating when these big water companies tell all of us not to use water and they're not actually tackling the leaks that exist. Nonetheless, we have got to pull together to make sure that we all get access to drinking water when it gets really hot.
The final question for this month comes from Mike. He said, I saw you at the Beer and Fizz Festival. Did you have a favourite beverage?
Ah, very good. Well, I was lured to the Beer and Fizz Festival with the promise of a particular cider that I've never tried called a Hazy Daisy. And when I turned up, it turns out that they hadn't managed to get it delivered in time. So it wasn't actually there. And Father Richard was very apologetic because this was at St. Saviour's Church. I did, however, try a cider called a Yellow Hammer, which is very fitting, given that Lib Dems are in the business of knocking down blue walls. So I particularly like the Yellow Hammer pint, and I'd be quite keen to have another one of those one day.
So that is the end of this week's politics podcast. I hope you have found the information useful. For this week, it's a goodbye, a good luck, and I'm wishing you the best of health and to see you again at the same time for next week's political interview.